Welcome to the Three Sisters Crime Squad. We are three sisters raised by an OG true crime lover, and we've been fixated on true crime ever since.
I'm Karen.
I'm Jana.
And I'm Brooke.
Please like and subscribe to our podcast on any podcast app that you like to listen to. We would love it if you would leave us a five-star review to help us move up the charts.
Also, if you want to join our squad, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Three Sisters Crime Squad. Or you can send us an email at threesistersincrime@gmail.com. That's the number three, not three spelled out.
All right, let's get to the show.
What a person.
What the You're at Aunt Brooke's.
There it is.
And hi, everyone.
This is a little chaotic tonight.
And hi, everyone.
Why are you so shy?
Go out. Go out. Go out.
Baby.
I got to get him out of the room. Go, Days. Go.
We got Cat.
Go, Days.
We got babies.
Yes.
We got chickens.
Like my two. We got everybody. Everybody came to the recording tonight. Although I just kicked the two cats out of the room because
Laura's getting kicked out.
Oh right. No!
He wants to play with Aunt Brookie, but I'll play with you when we're done. Okay,
just a little bit. Okay.
Hopefully this isn't.
You want to go play with Dilly?
Yeah.
I said Dilly, let's play.
All right. Oh. Bye, Flora.
This is the worst picture, so the caption will have to be something about it being chaotic because it's
okay
sideways.
Oh,
shut my door.
I my own self off. Oh dear,
that's funny. Well, and I don't think that we could take another picture.
It's going to be what it is. We'll just make a caption about it.
Yeah, like we just it is going to have to be that because we can't get it any better.
Wow, that was bad.
Yeah. So,
okay.
You had a busy day today? Is that what you were saying?
Busy. I mean, I'm not working or anything today, but somehow.
No, but you were gone all week, weren't you?
I was gone like the end of last week and the weekend. I just dinked around and then all of a sudden the day was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. Crazy.
My day was busy too. We have our business plan review tomorrow. And so I was just doing so much stuff. And then also I had a dentist appointment because I have a cracked filling.
Ow.
Yikes.
Yeah. So I had my teeth cleaned last week on Thursday and they were like, you know, your filling is cracked. And I was like, I didn't know, but I'm not surprised because I was like every now and then I would get like that tingling.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm not surprised. And she was like, well, we really probably should replace that. And I was like, well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, so, because I had to have a root canal.
Yeah.
That issue.
My dentist, I like her. She's really good. But she like way over numbs you. She, because honestly, I'm like, I've gotten fillings done with no numbing, but she won't let me do it. She every time I've said, do I have to have the shot? She says, I won't work on you if you don't.
Yeah, it hurts.
So she numbed me, and I'm not kidding you, my eyeball was numb. I am not kidding you. And my ears. So when I got back to work and I went to put my headphones in, have you ever tried to put headphones in and your ears are numb? It's freaky.
No.
It's so weird.
I can't feel it.
But like literally like, this part of my eye was numb.
I've had that before.
Yeah.
It was so weird feeling.
I don't know where it's at. I am not a good dental patient.
I'm a terrible dental patient.
I really dislike going. I mean, my dentist is so nice, but I'm like grumpy because I'm there. Like just for a cleaning. And then I hadn't had anything extra for a while, but
yeah cleanings don't bother me. I'm not nervous about cleanings, but anytime they have to do any sort of work on my teeth, I don't feel like I'm like a anxiety filled person, but I get that weird anxiety when they're gonna give me that, they put that numbing cream in and that makes me feel weird, and then they give you the shot and then I feel weird. I mean, she actually was like, when she was done, she was like, you did really good, although I was worried you were going to break the arms off our chair today. I was like, I was trying really hard not to like move your hands away from me. Like, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to like punch your hand away from me. Mm-hmm. She was like, well, I'm glad you didn't. So, anyway, so that was my day. And then I was numb until like 2:30. So I didn't get lunch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're like, I'm going to chew on my tongue.
Right. Well, and that's what I kept telling my boss too. Like, I'm afraid I'm going to bite my tongue.
Yeah.
And ow. She was like, well, don't do that. Anyway.
Anywho, I'm not plugged in. Am I okay on sound?
Yeah, you should be fine. I mean, you're not doing the bulk of the talking tonight, so I think you should be okay.
I know, I'm here for moral support. I'm so excited.
Yes, you get to be the peanut gallery.
Oh, look, who's back there?
Who's what?
Right here.
Hi.
What?
Oh, your cat is on the cat tree back there.
Oh, I didn't even see him. Oh, cute. I got to get a cat tree for my cats.
This one's real cute. I'll send it. I'll send you the link.
Okay. Okay.
Link in the bio.
All right. Anything else fun?
Oh, I don't even know. The last couple of weeks have just been busy, busy, busy. Like, seriously busy. Yeah. So
with school starting and stuff.
I don't know. Robert and I have some things going on, and just it's kept us busy. So. Just busy.
Yeah.
Now the kids are all busy too. So
yeah. Yeah.
That adds to everything.
Yeah. Understood.
When we were texting back and forth today, I mean, I couldn't even remember last week. It seemed so long ago.
Yeah. I was a little surprised when you were like, is it me? I was like, because you were like, I'm not going to be ready. And I was like, well, what do you have to do?
I know. You're probably like, wait, you just have to sit there and listen.
All right. Well, I can start whenever you guys are ready.
I'm ready.
Go for it. I'm like this thing.
Yeah. So this is going to be part two of our cold case, closed cold case. Girl, close that cold case. All right. So let us start in Bath, Somerset, England, in 1984. So just a little bit about Bath. It is the largest city in County Somerset. It is 97 miles west of London. And London and Bath are in the southern part of England. Liverpool and Manchester, those other cities, those are further north. So Bath is in the southern part. It is a large tourist city. There's tons of spas and theaters and art galleries, and it's like kind of like a summery climate. It's very temperate.
I've heard of it before.
Yeah. It's like a nice little area to go visit.
Okay. Teddy wants to go to Bath.
I'm waiting.
Like the movie Emma or one of those like British. Like, period.
It could be. It could be because it sounds like it is like, and then when I looked at the map, it's kind of coastal. It's not exactly right on the coast, but I think it's close.
Okay.
Enough. Okay. So, early on the morning of June 10th, Jean Rode and her husband, Tony, they wake up and find that their 17-year-old daughter, Melanie, has not returned home from a night out with friends. And so they are like in that weird, unsettling, like, should we be freaking out yet? Maybe we shouldn't. Let's not freak out, but I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
They're kind of very unsettled because she's, you know, she's, they said that it's not it wasn't unusual. It wasn't like out of the ordinary for her if she went out to not come home, but she would normally call first thing in the morning to tell her parents that she was at so-and-so's house. At around 9:15, in the morning. They are really like kind of deciding to make the phone call to the police, but they hadn't done it yet. And it's at this point that Jean hears a voice over a loudspeaker calling out the name Melanie. Is that my cat?
Yeah.
You're being too noisy, ma'am.
She's like, okay, sorry.
She's like, I'm up in this upstairs and I don't know where anybody is. Okay, sorry. All right, so they hear a policeman driving by in a car yet calling out the name Melanie. And so she like runs outside, bangs on the police car, like, stop. My daughter is named Melanie and she did not come home last night.
And why are you calling for her?
Yes. So the day before, on June 9th, Melanie was having a very normal weekend day. She had gone and played tennis with a friend. She went and did a little bit of shopping afterward. And then she went home to get ready to go out for the night. And so I don't know anything about the British education system. What they kept saying is that she was going to be taking her A-level exams on the next Monday. And I looked it up and then I was like trying to figure out how to explain the British education system and I can't. So the only thing that I can tell you is that the A-level exam is what you need to get into college. So okay. I think it's maybe kind of like a final exam for high school.
Or like the ACT?
Maybe. Yeah. Right. Something like that. So this was like her last night out before, you know, having to kind of like buckle down. So Melanie Rode is a bright and beautiful 17-year-old girl. She is the youngest of three children. She has an older sister whose name is spelled K-A-R-E-N, as in Karen, but they pronounced it Corin the entire time. Oh. So, yeah. So they're English, and I wanted to affect a British accent, but I can't, so... Like the whole time I was like listening to stuff about it that was like all these British people talking. And I was like, oh my gosh, I wish I could talk like that.
So if Corin is still, may I speak to your manager, or if that works with the British accent.
You know,
I'm going to change my name.
I got you. No, I don't think it goes. Although, you know what I heard? I heard instead of Karen, it's now Janet.
Oh, good.
Good. Sorry, damn it. Which I'm like, that's a little close to my name. It's not my name. Yeah. So Corin had just had a baby. He was 7 weeks old. And she was home visiting her mom and dad and her brother and sister there in Bath. She lives somewhere else. And I honestly could have looked it up, but I didn't look up where she was living. Also, Melanie has an older brother named Adrian. He is away at school in Edinburgh,
however,
Scotland,
the English.
Yes. He is in Scotland and he's very close with Melanie. They were close in age. They were, they studied together a lot. And, you know, he just, when he talked in one of the interviews that I heard, he was obviously very close with her. Melanie is a very popular girl, and this is because her father, when she was younger, his job had them moving around the country often. Every couple of years, they were moving to a new city. And Melanie was very adaptable, and she was very good at making friends wherever she went. Her mother said that she really loved to bake and that was kind of her way in. She would make a cake to share, and that kind of helped her break the ice with people. And that's how she would make friends. She's also extremely smart, and she had been moved ahead a year in school. So she was, you know, just kind of a really great girl. So Melanie and her friends on June 9th went to a nightclub in Bath called Beau Nash. And it's like this super trendy nightclub. They were playing disco music. The lighting was like dark red and purple lights that were like flashing around. And this town is actually like a pretty safe town, they felt like. There wasn't a lot of violent crime. So nobody really ever felt like they weren't safe going out in the evenings. Melanie and her boyfriend, they had met up at the nightclub to dance and drink. And it sounds like they were like able to legally drink, even though she was only 17. So I don't know what the legal drinking age was in England at the time, but I think it must have been younger than what she was. So I also want to like clue you guys in and drop this nightclub exactly to where it is in history by telling you that the number one song on June 9th, 1984 was Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go by Wham. Like, if that doesn't tell you where we are in history, nothing will. Also, I didn't know this. I learned this too. Tears for Fears, the band Tears for Fears, is from Bath. All the people in that band are from Bath. Okay, so the group that Melanie was out with consisted of her boyfriend and his brother, and then they had two other friends that were with them, and they had all stayed at Beau Nash. They didn't go anywhere else, and they were there when the club closed at 2 a.m. So at 2 a.m., they leave the club, and they start walking home, and they get to a point in the city where they kind of have to split off. Like, Melanie has to go one way to go to her parents' house. The boyfriend and friends have to go another direction. So she says, you know, I'll just walk home the rest of the way. It's only going to take me about 30 minutes to get home walking. I'm cool. You know, it's nice out, whatever. She wasn't worried about it. And she's like, I've done it so many times. And the boyfriend's like, well, let me get you a cab. And she still says no, that, you know, she's cool. She doesn't need it. Right. So she is the last time that she is seen alive is when she is walking across its Pulteney Bridge, which is kind of like a famous bridge in the city center. And so as she's heading away from that city center into the suburbs on that bridge is the last time anybody could report seeing her alive. So nobody really knows exactly the route that she took. There's a couple different ways that she could have made her way. All right. So the next day at 5:30 a.m., an 11-year-old boy who is helping his father, a milkman, he walks down a walkway to deliver milk to a house, and he comes across the body of a woman. He goes back and finds his dad and is like, there's something wrong with this lady down there. And so the dad goes back and he says like, this just looked like a mannequin or like a person sleeping on the sidewalk. And but he said that he knew immediately that she was dead. She is 200 meters from her house, which is 0.12 miles. Not that far. There are also a ton of houses close by, but no one has heard anything. Like, nobody called the police in the middle of the night or anything at all. The only way that they can identify her is there's like a wall, like a retaining wall, next to the sidewalk where she is. And her keys are like on that wall, and they have like a little, the key ring has something attached to it that has her name on it. And so it is, that's how they assumed that this was Melanie. There's no purse or anything around. They only have this key ring. And so then that's when the one cop goes driving around with a loudspeaker saying, does anyone know Melanie? Does anyone know the name? Yes. So there's not very many clues at the scene where Melanie's body was found. Police do find a trail of blood leading away from Melanie's body. And so they assume that this is the killer's blood.
They follow this blood trail. It goes like back up the road. There's like a set of stone steps that it goes up. And there's like a couple of places where the blood drops will disappear. And then there's also some, and then, you know, like the trail will pick up somewhere else. And then there's also a couple spots where it's like really concentrated where there's like a whole bunch of drops. And so they're thinking that the killer maybe had like stopped and was waiting or talking to somebody at that point. So they follow this trail into the city center where it then disappears. They think maybe the guy got into a car or something. As this news is making its way around town that they found this dead body of this young woman or young girl, they start to get some calls coming into the police station. One witness calls the police and tells them that they had found a blood-stained glove, which they go and collect. Another person in town says that they had checked into a hotel and there was a sink full of blood. So there's a couple, and I'm not going to like, I don't think I go back into any of these things. These two specifically turn out to be red herrings. The sink turns out to be something else that wasn't related to it. And then the bloody, and I'm using quotes here, the bloody glove is actually not blood. So, yeah. So the same day that Melanie's body was found, the coroner did do a post-mortem examination on her body, and they determined that she had been stabbed 26 times, with most of the stab wounds were like kind of centered around her breasts. They also determined that most of the wounds come to the right side of her body, which makes the investigators think that the attacker was left-handed. Melanie was also sexually assaulted, and they found semen in two places on her body, which leads them to believe that there was two separate sexual attacks. So they weren't sure if this is two people or two times. So, and this is, you know, 1984. So DNA stuff is coming around. I think that, you know, like investigators are starting to hear about DNA, but it's not in practical usage yet. At this point, the only thing that they could do was look at the blood types. So again, these investigators in Bath are trying to be extremely thorough with this case. We are about 2 years off of Peter Sutcliffe. And if we remember in the Peter Sutcliffe story, the police in that story were highly criticized for not really putting in a whole lot of work. So there was definitely a lot of, poor police work in the Peter Sutcliffe work or case. And so Bath, the police in Bath are obviously kind of like very cognizant of this, and they're trying to be thorough. So at the start of this investigation, they actually put 80 to 100 officers working this case from the very start. I mean, they were very gung-ho and very like, we want to get this solved. They blocked off huge sections of the road. They conducted house-to-house canvasses, like, a couple different times. And, you know, they got information out to the news. Like, they put this on, you know, reports on the news. They talked to reporters. They were definitely very proactive in trying to solve this case. They were looking for her purse, which they never did find. They did get out information to the people in the city that, you know, there may have been somebody who was injured, and that, you know, if one of your family members suddenly has an injury that they can't account for, you know, like this might be something to look at. They also then at the same time began to try and track Melanie's last movements. Of course, they go to her boyfriend, who is very quickly ruled out because of his alibi. He and his brother had returned to their flat, and other roommates that lived there did verify that they both were there. But they still, they don't have very much. Bath is considered an international city because there are so many tourists around. Students from all over the world come to study at the colleges in Bath. There was a report of a bus tour of people that were from Canada and they were getting ready to leave like the next day to go to France. So, you know, you kind of have all this like transient population of people, which I know people think transient means homeless, but it's also people that are not here, but are on the move all the time. So they weren't, you know, obviously, is this a local person? Is this a sociopath? Is this a first time killer? What do we have here? And they really just don't know. They did get a pretty big breakthrough fairly early in the case when forensic analysts identified the killer. So Melanie and the killer both had the same type of blood. It was A positive, but the male killer had a specific enzyme known as PGM2-1+. And this is a protein in the blood that they were then able to map out the blood spots found at the scene. They created a map of the area and they marked out all of the areas that were Melanie's blood in red. And then they marked the killer's blood with green. So anything that had this unusual protein was drawn on the map in green. And so from this point on, the investigators refer to the killer as having green blood. The rare protein is found only in 3% of the male population. And the investigators felt that this would help them identify the killer because it is, you're looking at such a small group. The blood group was used to rule out suspects from this point on. So they had arrested 94 different people. And then of that 94, 19 of them had that protein. So had that green blood. And then, so they then had to like verify the alibis and eliminate these 19 men, which they did. So investigators, this murder case was considered the largest manhunt in Bath up to that point. And it also becomes one of the longest.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is also 1984. So we don't have computers. And because this was such a large investigation, it was very difficult for them to manage. They came up with this index card system, for the suspects, and everything had to be compared. As the way that they did the cards, that they explained it is each person that they, you know, identified anywhere in the city had a card created, and then they had to check the information against all the other cards. So it would be like they had a card for the street, and on that street it had all the names of the people that said that they were on that street at such and such time. And then, so then if they, you know, if you said I'm Bob Smith and I was on Main Street, they would go to Main Street and see, do they have Bob Smith already on that card? So they were, and they had all these other cards that were also not just for location. They had it for fingerprints. They had it for blood type. They had it for somebody with like criminal record. I mean, they had multiple cards for every single piece of information in the case, and they were constantly having to go back and re-verify every single piece of information on every single card. I mean, it's so cumbersome, but that was the only way that they could do it. So then if they found something that didn't add up, then they would go back and they would re-verify all the information. So it was very meticulous how they had to go about all of this. And it had to be done thousands of times each day. So that just goes to show you like, man, computers are so nice. I'm so glad we have technology. So they were very singularly focused on who would have killed a 17-year-old girl. But 6 months after the murder, they're still nowhere. They're back at number one. And they, you know, they obviously they have to peel off some of the investigators on it. They don't have 1,000 people or 100 police officers working on this investigation, you know, for 6 solid months. They did, with this card system, identify 3 people of interest that had been out in the street on the night when Melanie was murdered. There was a guy that had been seen jogging. There was somebody on a bicycle, a cyclist. And then there was a man sitting on the church steps of this church in the center of the city. So they put this call out for, if you are this jogger, or this cyclist, or this person on the steps, please come forward. You may have information that could help us. They never do find these 3 men, just FYI. Yeah. But they really focused on, for several years, trying to get this information from these 3 men, and it just doesn't ever pan out. Mm. So in 1995, the UK does set up a national DNA database with profiles of sex offenders and burglars. So this is looked at as, you know, like maybe kind of a step forward. It's obviously pretty early in the game of DNA. And because I think that the first ever in the world DNA case happened in England in 1986. So England's definitely on the forefront of this DNA technology. Okay, so in June, on June 9th, 1996, the Euro 96 football tournament is taking place. England is going to be playing Switzerland, and it is, you know, we all know that football is, you know, the greatest pastime in England, and they're crazy for their footballers. So the pubs are full of people all watching this game. 25-year-old Melanie Hall was out with her boyfriend and her 2 friends at a nightclub called Cadillacs. The friends and her boyfriend left that evening, and Melanie stayed behind afterwards.
Another Melanie.
And June 9th.
Okay.
Yeah. You caught on real quick, Karen. Corin.
Corin.
So, yeah, the next day, Melanie Hall's parents call the police because Melanie did not return home. Police began searching for Melanie Hall. They offered a $10,000 reward, which in 1996 is the equivalent of $15,297 US, or today it would be $26,616. Yeah. So a young police officer named Julie McKay, or McKay, they pronounced it McKay, but it's spelled McKay, was assigned to the Melanie Hall investigation. It's during this inquiry that Julie then learns of the murder of Melanie Rode. And of course, police make the same connection that you made. And they, you know, they say same night, same name. And they're, you know, like, what is happening? Unfortunately, with the Melanie Hall disappearance, there's nothing forensically because they have not found her body. She's literally just missing, but they did presume her to be dead pretty early on in their investigation, which I don't know why.
Yeah,
they didn't really elaborate on that, but they thought that she had gone off somewhere. They definitely were like, she's dead. So again, I don't know why. Also during this time, there was a serial rapist that had begun operating in Bath beginning in 1991. There had been 10 rapes to date, with a 3-year gap happening kind of in the middle there. Police in that investigation were also taking DNA samples of suspects and trying to match them against the DNA that was found, or the blood type that was found in the Melanie Rode case. But of course, nothing came of that. Okay. 13 years after the disappearance of Melanie Hall, a road crew working on cleaning up trash and debris discover 8 black trash bags buried in the underbrush on the side of the road. The contents of the bags were the dismembered remains of Melanie Hall. Her parents identified a ring that she had worn on her middle finger. It was like her grandmother's wedding ring, and it had been given to her, and they were like, she's never without it. She never takes it off. She was later conclusively identified using dental records.
I was going to say, this had to be some pretty gross remains.
Yeah, right, 13 years later. Yeah. And they did think that they had been there a while. It wasn't like they had just been dumped. So this, of course, creates an explosion in both of the Melanie investigations, Melanie Hall's and Melanie Rhodes. But nothing comes of it. So it's 13 years after Melanie Hall's disappearance. It's 2009. A nurse calls the police station to report a man that she was caring for gave a deathbed confession. She did not give her name. She left it anonymously. And so they had to really like do a lot of research to figure out who this was. And I still don't know how they did. But when they did finally figure out who the man was, he had already died. They had to get permission from the family to collect DNA. So they found a blood pressure cuff, because once you die, it's really hard to get DNA. I don't know if you know that, because like your body isn't creating saliva anymore. And I don't know. But they did find a blood pressure cuff at the man's house that had skin cells on it. And so they were able to use that to build a profile. They also got some slides that had been taken from the hospital for, I don't know, I think he had cancer or something. And so they compared these slides to the profile that was found in the semen on Melanie Road. And they at first thought that it was going to be a match, and then they determined that it wasn't. So they're back to the drawing board again. I'm going to tell you a whole bunch of these kinds of things that happened, because this team working on this case never, ever gave up. I mean, it is incredible the amount of work that they put into this. So after the Melanie Hall situation, Julie McKay officially joins the cold case team. And at the time that they're investigating this deathbed confession, that's when she starts to look at the Melanie Road files. And she just couldn't let go of the similarities in the two different cases. But she just was hooked on the idea of catching Melanie Road's killer. Julie requested that all of the case files be brought to her. And so she got everything. She had all of the index cards from the original investigation. She had the canvas notes from the house to house canvassing that was done at the time of the murder. There was video of the crime scene that she watched that they had taken the day that Melanie Rhodes' body was found. There was a police officer that like filmed the blood trail, and he filmed all the people that were standing around. And so she got all of that. 2009 was also the 25th anniversary or year since Melanie's murder. And there's a show in England called Crime Watch, and they did a special anniversary on Melanie's murder. And they aired like a number that people could call to call in tips. And immediately the police started getting tips. And I think that, you know, I think this happens with anything, any sort of cold case. So these tips generated a list of 72 names for the police to run down. And Julie McKay basically was like, or McKay was like, we are going to work every one of these 72 names. Okay. Wow. 5 months after the special, what?
It's a lot after 25 years, 72 more.
It is. Yeah. Well, I know. That's what I think too, because so much gets lost over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Forgotten. Yeah.
Right. So 5 months after, and you're going to love this part, speaking of what you just brought up about things being lost over time. So 5 months after the special aired in October of 2009, the police got a call from a man named Ben. And he tells them that he thinks that he had seen Melanie having an argument with a man on the side of the road. So after seeing this Crime Watch special in June, he's just like, I can't sleep. I'm a nervous wreck. I'm upset that I think I saw this. Mm-hmm. So they go to his house and they interview him. He provides them with an incredible amount of detail. So they say that this man was on the spectrum. And because of this, because of his position on the spectrum, he just has this incredible recall, and he's able to give them a lot of information.
On the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and they actually, there's another thing that they said, that one of the investigators said, was that he kept telling the story in present tense. And remember in the Joanne Lees case, they had said kind of the same thing, that that's very common for you to, if you're reliving the details where you can see it, that you would switch and tell the story in the present tense. So that came up in this one. And I thought that was very interesting that to hear that little point. Yeah. So Ben says that he's certain he saw this girl. He says that he was coming home from his job and it was about 3 a.m. He was driving a camper van down the street. And so the road that he lived on kind of made like a curve. And he says, as he gets to that curve and comes around, he sees a blonde girl arguing with a man on the side of the road. And he says, as his lights crossed over them from him making this turn, Melanie starts to walk down the street. And he says that the man that was arguing with her was right behind her. And he says that she looked at him, made eye contact with him, and that she looked very scared. And he used the word ashen, like her face was ashen. The man that she is arguing with is right behind her. And Julie McKay says that based on the injuries to Melanie's body, and she doesn't tell Ben this, she tells the listeners this, that she was being prodded with a knife in her back. So he was like holding a knife to her back and like prodding her along. Ben did not know that. He did not know that part, but he basically was like, she was walking. He was walking very close behind her. So obviously he was trying to control her. Ben says that he drives farther down the road, closer to his house, and he parks his van. And as he gets out and as he's walking towards the door to his house, he hears a woman scream. So he says at that point, then he kind of like turns and walks back up the road towards where he had seen these two people. And he said, as he's going up the road, he sees the man come from around the corner real fast. Like he's like rushing away. And Ben says something to him like, did you have a fight with your girlfriend, or, you know, something along those lines. And the man says, yes. And then he runs along the road towards those stone steps and out of sight. So Ben's story matches very closely with what they had found as far as like that green blood trail and mm-hmm. any of the other forensic evidence of details that he did not know that they knew. You know, like the prodding with the knife and obviously that green blood trail. So this is, I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine what they felt hearing this story from him all of this time when it matches, you know, it matches everything that they have. They actually even had him draw out a map and it, you know, she was like, you could just lay it right over top and it matched up perfectly. So they show, so they also tried to get him to do what's called an e-fit. And he's like, oh, yeah, I definitely would recognize this man to this day. Like his face is in my memory. But unfortunately, with like British law, there's some like weird privacy laws and things that they have. And what's called an e-fit, which is like a photo lineup, that can only be done within 48 hours of the crime. So a 26-year-old murder cannot be done. But Ben is an artist, so he draws them a picture of who he saw. So now they have a composite. They now have an eyewitness that can put the person there. And they just really felt like, okay, we've got some pieces that are going to help us solve this case. Now, everybody wants to know, and I'm sure you're probably asking about why this man waited 26 years to come forward.
My number one question.
Why? So, well, it turns out that Ben actually came forward the day of the murder. And he talked to one of the officers that were standing at the barricade where they had cordoned off the area. Mm-hmm. And he told them that he had seen something the night before and he felt like he had information that they could use. That police officer asked him where he lived and he pointed out his house, which was just kind of like a few doors away from where they were standing. And the police officer said, hey, don't worry, they'll pick you up on the house to house. So nobody ever came to his house though. So they didn't pick him up on the house to house, which right. is what that other police officer was thinking. They found in that video footage of the crime scene, they can see him kind of like milling around. He's got a very serious look on his face and he's like, you know, they see it's on the video, him going up and talking to the police officer. So that also checks out his story. Julie went back and pulled out the files of the house to house search to see, you know, what did he tell the officers that came to his house? And they stopped one house before his. Ugh. I know. So, and she even says that, like, what luck is this? Like, one more house. Mm-hmm. If they had just knocked on one more door. So it's just, it's like nothing, nobody did anything wrong. It's just one of those things that just happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unfortunate. It's so unfortunate.
Well, and they now, had some small little leads, maybe two at that mm-hmm. time, that maybe thought, well, this knocking door to door isn't going to, need to follow these other leads.
Yeah, and actually Ben even kind of said that too. Like he said, when nobody ever came to my house and knocked on my door, I just figured that you must have caught whoever it was and you didn't need the information that I had. So, right. And he does say that he did call a couple other times, but both times that he had been called or that he had called the police station, he'd been told once that they didn't know what he was talking about and just like they just didn't take him seriously. So one of the other things that he told the investigators is that he knows he has seen this same man in other places around Bath. So he tells them a couple different places he'd seen him at, like a football club and then also at a snooker club in Bath.
What is a
which I'm like, I have no idea what snooker mm-hmm. is. I know it's a game. I think it's kind of like pool.
Oh,
is
that maybe like a bar
yeah.
or something else?
No, I think it's like, I think it's like pool.
Okay.
So it was like a pool hall.
Oh.
This building that was the snooker club in 1984 later became the nightclub Cadillacs.
Oh, where the second girl.
Yeah. Yes. So by sheer chance in the Melanie Hall investigation, police had taken the club records from Cadillacs because, you know, like people belong to this club, so they would have to sign in. And in those records was also the snooker club records.
Oh.
So they were like, let's see if we can come up with anything. Now, unfortunately, nothing comes over it. They don't make any connections with anything of this. But, you know, it's like I'm telling you all of these like things that keep happening that they just were working and they were like trying to come at this from every angle. And they like, I think they felt like, okay, we're making a step forward. And then it would just be like nothing. It wouldn't pan out for them. Another tip comes in 2011 for a man that had recently died. And so Julie McKay has to go and get consent from his family to take a DNA swab so that they can test if this guy really is, you know, this person that called in this tip with this name, mm-hmm. Because he was going to be cremated like the next day for the funeral. So she was like racing this clock to like get to him before they cremate him. Mm-hmm. Again, it doesn't turn out to be a match. And I want you to understand that these investigators had such urgency to work on this even after 25 years. Throughout the investigation, Julie McKay became very close with Melanie's mother, Jean, and they developed a very close friendship. They would go out and have lunch or dinner together, and she like helped her do some yard work and stuff like that. She was really sweet to Melanie's mother. So the cold case team is trying to come at finding this murderer in any direction that they can. They felt like this eyewitness testimony for Ben and his drawing would be helpful, but it wasn't getting them where they needed to be. So they wanted to continue down this DNA road because at this point in 2011, DNA is becoming extremely helpful. Right. You know, there's so much more technology and they're able to do so much more with it by 2011. And here's a detail that I was really shocked to find out. In 2001, the previous cold case team had tried to use familial DNA to identify any person with that shared DNA. So mm-hmm. remember in 1995, they had started the National DNA Database. Mm-hmm. I did not think that anybody had thought about familial DNA until like 2018 when they did it with the Golden State Killer. But here in 2001 in England, they were actually trying to use that same process. Unfortunately, in 2001, the database wasn't very big or, you know, so we've got more time on this. They're hoping that maybe, you know, this larger database will have something. So they try this route again, and they sent the profile that was found with Melanie, from the semen on Melanie. And they ask for the closest DNA match. And they get back a list of names with all of these like weird percentages attached to it. And she was like, you know, when you first see it, it just looks like a bunch of numbers and it doesn't make any sense. But by the second day, you're like a pro at it. So she says that the person at the top of the list was a DNA match of 44,000 to 1, like that it was a match. So yeah. The scientist was like, and oh, wait. So the first person at the top of the list was 44,000 to 1. The next person below was 17,000 to 1. So it was a huge difference. And the scientist told him, like, this is what we call a screamer because it's screaming out that it is so high, that the percentage is so high of a match. Wow. And the scientist even said, like, this person has to be a relative of your murderer because they're so closely matched. So they knew that, this name that's on their list is not their killer because it's a woman and she would have been too young, but it could be her dad, her uncle, her brother. So Julie McKay and her second person in her investigation team is a guy named Gary. They track down this girl and they look at all of her male relatives. And this person lived in Ipswich, which is on the other side of England. It's closer to London. But they were doing a background check to see if they could find that, you know, she lived or this, her dad lived in Bath or something. They were looking for a connection. They found a connection to a city that was close by, but not Bath. So her dad ran a small business and he had no criminal record. They actually felt like his brother was a better match because he did have a criminal record. He was considered promiscuous. He liked younger women. There was some like weird postings on his Facebook. And so they went to see the woman's father at his workplace. And, you know, they explained to him why they were there, that they were searching for a murder. And she said that, you know, he asked a bunch of questions. And, you know, he was immediately like, well, I didn't murder anybody. And But, you know, so she answered all of his questions. And then she said, would you mind giving us a DNA swab? And he agreed and said, sure. So she took the swab and she, you know, she was going to send it back. She did say this. She said, whenever she would go and ask any of their suspects if they would give her a swab, and if they said no, she would say, like, that's okay. But I want you to know that just because you say no doesn't mean that I won't get a swab.
Yeah.
She's like, because I will put you under surveillance. I will, you know, I'm going to do any way that I can to get your DNA. So just because you're telling me no doesn't mean that I won't figure it out, which I was like, I love that. I just love it that she just like straight up said it to people like, okay, you're going to tell me no, that's fine, but I'm still going to get it. Right. It's just going to be a little harder. So she did say that she had a gut feeling that this was not going to be their guy. But so she took, they did the swab from her, and then they also did the swab from the second name on the list. And a few weeks later, they get an answer back that there is no match to the profile of the unknown male. Oh. So they start over again, and they decide to go back to this index card system from the original investigation to look at the house-to-house search and see if there's anything that maybe they had missed at the time. You know, like maybe there was a name of somebody and, you know, like now they're maybe seeing this name a couple different ways of people, you know, just they just kind of were going back to rechecking everything. They wanted to also try to get some more DNA swabs from men that were listed on the index cards. They had 8,000 names on these index cards. And so they also started to cross-reference, like looking for criminal records, because in England, if you commit a crime and you're arrested, they immediately draw your DNA and put it into that database. So they, you know, they would like look up the name. Does this guy have a criminal record? Is there possibly a profile? You know, like they were just kind of really trying to do a whole bunch of different things. They did create what they called a criminal offense matrix. And basically they took the name of all of the men and they started this like scoring system. And they had, you know, like if you had a criminal offense, it was this many points. If you were found at this road, it was this many points. And they basically, as they did that, anybody who scored over a 50, they automatically would like track them down and get a DNA swab from them. So that they started this criminal offense matrix in 2015. So, or 2014, it had been 3 years since they had done the familial DNA where they got that first hit. And so one of the investigators came up and was like, let's try it again. It's been 3 years. You know, we've got three more years of people added to this DNA system. So this is now in its 30th year of investigation. Julie McKay gets a promotion and she is given a chance to put together her own cold case team. And so she starts a program in her station that she called Suspect of the Week. I think now they run it Suspect of the Month. And basically information signs were made up and put all around their police department. And it was basically like information so that other patrol officers and stuff could also look at, you know, run down clues and like look for things. At this point, they were worried that Melanie's killer may be dead. And then it would be really hard for them to find because obviously you're not going to get any of that new DNA. But Julie was like, I would not even like entertain that idea. Like anytime somebody would bring it up, she was just like, I don't want to hear that because I don't want to believe that I can't solve this case. There was also, yeah. So DNA was not giving them the breakthrough that they were really hoping for. I mean, I know they thought that this was just going to be a grenade into the middle of the case and it just never turned out to be that. They kept going back to everything. So one of the other things that they did, they went back to Melanie's clothing and crime scene photos, and they realized that Melanie's shoe had been taken off of her feet and then put back on. So they sent her shoes to the lab, and they did find a full fingerprint on the back of the shoe. Well, in the 80s, fingerprints are not done on computers. They're done on cards. So they had to compare ridge detail from the shoe to cards that were taken in the 80s. Like, it had to be done by hand with a magnifying glass. And so they like started going crazy, like trying to, like, everything that they tried to do to come up with who this suspect could be, it just seemed like it was like so much harder for them because nothing's on computers.
They're not you know? Leaving like anything unturned either.
They really weren't. So the sad thing is, they were so excited about this one fingerprint that they found. And after weeks and weeks of checking all the, you know, hand checking fingerprints, they find out that it's the fingerprint of one of the scientists.
Oh.
So they were crushed.
I knew that was
what
I felt in my bones that was coming.
Yeah. So after they get crushed with this fingerprint not turning out to be anything that they can use, Gary goes to Julie and he's like, what happened to the familial DNA list? I thought we were resubmitting that. And she's like, hey, I did. She's like, let me give him a call. So she calls him and they're like, oh, we didn't run it. We'll run it right now and get it to you. So they run the list, and when it comes back, there are two new names listed. The original screamer is still on the list, but now there is a name above it and one below it, which one above means it's an even stronger match. So in 2015, a woman in Bristol was arrested on completely unrelated charges. Her and her boyfriend had gotten into a fight, and I guess it was like physical or whatever. But because she was arrested, her DNA is put into the system. Literally 2 days before they ran the familial DNA test.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So good thing it got delayed.
Exactly. This is like the one good happenstance. Like, yeah. Everything else has been like, you know, like, oh, we think this is going to be it, and then it isn't. And this time it is, we didn't do it on time, but it's a good thing that we didn't do it on time. So obviously she pops up as a screamer to the unknown male in Melanie Rhodes' case. And they like are so psyched that because this is such a higher match. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's a girl, so we know she's not the murderer. She's also too young. So they go to look into her father, her uncle, and her brother, which she doesn't have a full-fledged brother. She only has a stepbrother. And so they do this background check, and they find that she has a 63-year-old father named Christopher Hampton. Now, there's a problem because they have two Christopher Hamptons living in the same area. So they call her. Her name is Claire. And they ask her, which of these Christopher Hamptons is your father? And she points them in the right direction. And then she gives them his phone number. Yeah. So with this information, they're able to do a little bit more background check. And they find out that Christopher Hampton had been born and raised in Bath. He had also been married while he was living in Bath. And so he was 32 at the time. In 1984, he was 32. And he did live in Bath at the time of Melanie Rhodes' murder. They did also find employment records and a car registration from that same time period. He has no criminal convictions at all. None. Which is astounding to me. Like, I'm just so shocked. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how somebody can commit a murder and then never do it again, but continue to live with themselves, yeah. You know? So obviously this is our guy. I'm not going to beat around the bush. So Gary, the investigator, I think his last name was Martin. I didn't write it down, which is really weird. I don't know why I didn't. He went he himself goes to take this guy swab. He like calls him up and he, you know, tells him what's going on. And he agreed. He was like, yeah, you can come and get my DNA. I'll meet you at such and such place. So Gary's like, I just didn't trust anybody else to do it. So I went and did it myself. He willingly, without hesitation, gives it to him. They also go to the second person that had showed up that was below the original screamer. And at that time, both swabs are sent and a rush order is placed. They were very cautious, obviously, over all of this time. They had, you know, a lot of things had not panned out for them. They had, over the course of this investigation of 31 years, eliminated 2,711 people. So the years coming at this from so many different angles just really, you know, I know they had to be like, if this isn't it, I don't know what I'll do. Forensic scientists emailed the cold case team. This one guy, he emails Gary and he's like, hey, I have news, but I'm getting ready to go into a meeting. Give me a call in about an hour. And the interview that I saw with Gary, he was like, I did not even know what to do. He's like, I called him right away, but he must have already left his desk. But he was like, I couldn't believe the email was like, call me in an hour.
Yeah.
Like, I know. Patient. Can you imagine? So he finally gets a hold of the guy and he says, we found a match to your unknown male profile. And Gary says, who is it? And he says, it's Christopher Hampton. So they had five weeks earlier taken that swab, and now they finally had a match. On July 6th, 2015, police were waiting for Christopher Hampton outside of his home. They watched him come home from work and walk into his house, and they went and knocked on the door. They put him under arrest. Christopher Hampton, we are arresting you for the 1984 murder of Melanie Road. And as they're walking him out the door, his wife and daughter are there. And the wife says, I'll see you later. And he says, no, you won't. Oh. And then she says, well, I'll see you tomorrow. And he says, no, you won't. And Julie McKay says, I knew at that moment that this was the right man. So Julie, so
was he admitting guilt?
Well, I think he knew that they had him.
Yeah.
Like he knew they had enough to get him. So Julie just couldn't wait. She said that she called Jean to tell, you know, she was like, hey, are you at home? And Jean was like, well, I'm getting ready to go to dinner. And she was like, well, can you wait? Like, I'm coming to see you. And so so Jean waits around and she, you know, obviously gets to tell her. The other one, the other kind of fun, not fun, but the other one that was, I don't know, Adrian early on in the investigation had told Julie that it hurt him too much, that he didn't want to talk to her anymore. He said, don't call me unless you found him. And so Julie, obviously she called him and he said, I told you not to call me. And she said, well, I found him. And he said, he just broke down into tears right then and there. So it took police 31 years to find him, but they finally identified the man who killed Melanie Road. There's just a few more things. The English judicial system, obviously it's very different from ours. So once they arrest somebody, they can only question them for 24 hours and then they either have to charge them or let them go. They can get a 12-hour extension. So he did, when they took him in, he did write a statement saying that he was not responsible for the murder of Melanie Road. There is also like these weird legalities with the DNA swab. So the swab that Gary had taken from him on the side of the road is called an intelligence swab and it can't be used in trial. So once they get the DNA match, they actually have to get a different swab or a different sample that has to be fully compared for prosecution. So they were working kind of against time with that 24-hour questioning period. And then also having to get that second DNA match. So what happened then? So they can only hold him for 24 hours and then they can get an extension for 12. And at the end of that time period, they have to charge him. Well, they can't charge him without getting that prosecution DNA match. So they basically, like, as soon as they arrested him and brought him back, they did the new DNA sample and they rushed it off to the lab. Well, this is on a Friday and the lab was going to close for the whole week. And she, like, basically had to tell them, you cannot leave. You have to stay and you have to do this so that we don't have to release him. Because once they release him, they cannot rearrest him if they don't have new evidence. So they really were up against a time clock on this one. Thankfully, everything worked out. You know, they definitely had to, like, push and rush for things, but they were able to do it so that they could get what they needed to charge him. So basically, they did charge him. He was in prison. He never answered any questions about the attack. He never gave a reason. Yeah. So he originally pleaded not guilty. But by the time of his trial in October 2015, he changed his plea to guilty. And guilty is actually the only word that he spoke in court. And he was sentenced to 32 years to life in prison. He has to serve a minimum of 22 years. He'll be like 86 years old if he ever gets out. The judge, when she sentenced him, said, you married and had a child and lived your family life for all of those years, knowing the extreme misery you have inflicted on your victim's family. But you were too callous and cowardly to put an end to their heartache. You will very likely die in prison.
Oh, wow.
And just on a side note.
I think
yeah.
Family deserves, not that they want to know what his motive was or whatever, but just why so senseless?
He went on to have children.
Yeah, and have a normal life. A business. Right.
Right. No, he didn't own a business.
Oh, it was the other
one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I will also say that they have not found the killer of Melanie Hall. They do not believe that them two murders are connected. And they, you know, the investigation is still ongoing in her murder, which I'm like, man, as like determined as they were in the Melanie Road case, I really think, you know, hopefully they'll get somebody in that case too.
Yeah. I've never heard this story.
So I do want to tell you, I got all of my information from the BBC, ITV, the Daily Mirror, and there was a podcast called Finding Melanie's Killer that I listened to that was done by the ITV reporter. So
good. Yeah.
I liked it.
They were really,
that's why I wanted to tell it, because I just could not every little thing they tried. Like, I guess, I think sometimes when you think of a cold case, you think, oh, it sat on a shelf for a really long time and nobody was working it. And that was not the case. That wasn't what was happening here. They were actively working this case the entire time, which I loved.
Yeah, I like that too. They did not, like I said, they did not leave a stone unturned. And they turned the stone over four times.
Right. So many times. They literally were like, I know, I loved it.
Good. Yeah. I'm glad her family did get some closure.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Very good. Yeah.
And I do hope he dies in prison.
Right. I hope he never gets out. He does not deserve
for him to get to live a normal life. That's not fair.
Right.
Not fair.
It's not fair. Okay.
All right.
Good job.
That's a good one, Jane.
Thanks.
I can hear Flora downstairs.
Is she playing?
Yeah. Her little feet are like.
I'm so jealous.
I am too.
I like.
Although I have eight little.
Conference.
Yes. Oh my gosh, those little kittens are so cute.
Yeah.
They're so fun.
So fun. Cat's fun.
Yeah. So does anybody have a bad guy?
Oh my gosh, I do. Let me go grab my phone. Hold on.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I forgot it was me.
You were yawning. Was I putting you to sleep?
It's going to take me seriously. Dale and I stayed out too long, drank too much, ate too much. It was 9,000 degrees. We sweat about 20 buckets of sweat. Stayed up 2 a.m. three nights in a row. It's going to take me.
Yeah, you're not in college anymore.
No doubt. Okay. Let me... Not definitely not in college. I am 50 and I feel every ounce of it right now. this says Maine police arrest man for DUI on riding lawnmower.
Yes.
So I always
Karen. It'd be you.
I always think this when I see people riding a lawnmower around town. Like, have you
ever
come across people who like use their lawnmower as a vehicle?
Yes. I mean, I'm not too often because of where I live, but I have seen it before.
Okay. So officers in Augusta, Maine Police Department posted to their social media, two patrol officers parked behind a riding lawnmower that had been reportedly ridden by an individual accused of operating the vehicle under the influence. According to the NBC News, the agency said it is not uncommon for a DUI on a lawnmower in your case in the wintertime.
Well, okay. But still, it's not uncommon.
Yeah. One person that drove by said, I drove by during the field sobriety test and he could hardly stand. Another person said,
his
wife must have taken his car keys away.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Oh no.
That is the story of the dummy on the lawnmower.
I didn't know you could get a DUI on a lawnmower.
You can get one on a boat. You
can get a moving vehicle. It's a moving, yeah.
I never. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm thinking if you're going to drive drunk, I'd rather you be on a lawnmower.
You can't damage pretty much just yourself.
I just picture.
Right.
I remember when you got your new rider, you were like, it doesn't have a cup holder, or you only wanted it because it did have a cup holder so you could still have your cocktail while you mow.
I did not have a cup holder on my lawnmower, and I had Dale install a cup holder.
Your lawnmower has a cup holder on it? Well, that's hilarious.
Come with them now, but yeah, mine is older and it didn't have one. And I'm like, where's my cocktail go? And Dale put one on for me. So,
I used to have a meme that said, this vacuum cleaner doesn't even have a cup holder. I mean, it's like they don't even want me to do housework.
It's like they don't even want me to have fun. Yeah.
Right. Oh, yep.
There you go.
Well, that's a good one. I like a drunk lawnmower story.
Yeah. Nobody got hurt in the making of this stupid
game. Yeah, so I'm pretty glad about that. Let's have something fun.
Yay.
All right.
Yay.
Well, we got another cold case next week. Is it you, Brooke?
Yeah, and I have one because I thought I was going.
Oh, good. Oh, that's hilarious. I know you made me laugh so hard this when you were like, I'm not ready. I was like, you don't need to be.
Yeah. And I was, I didn't remember either.
That's good. All right.
All right.
Well, everybody have a good week.
Yay. See ya.
Bye.